With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher
Fight. Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hello, hope you're doing well, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Tim Croskaval, I am assistant editor at Video Week, and I'm stepping in for your usual host Vincent Flood, who is taking some very well-earned annual leave after Cannes. And on that note, this week's podcast is a special episode which was recorded live in Cannes at our aptly named event, Video Week Live. We spent a morning on the beautiful Marais rooftop overlooking the Crozet, thrashing out some of the big topics in CTV. Before we get into it, I'd like to say a big thank you to all our partners for this year's event. That's Cinemedia, IAS, Uptalk TV, Epsilon, Bedrock Platform, Swivel, Virtual Minds, Dailymotion, and TiVo Ads. I'd also like to say a big thanks to everyone who came along and to all of our speakers as well. Whether you're at Cannes this year or not, you'll, I'm sure, have heard endless discussion about just how hot it was. And that was as true on the Marais rooftop as it was anywhere else. So a big thanks to everyone who peeled themselves away from their various air-conditioned spots to join us up there. We had three sessions at this year's event, all of which we're including in this podcast. The first of these was a discussion of the role of telcos in the addressable TV ecosystem. Now, this is something we've been writing about for years. I remember covering it fairly early on in my time at Video Week when I started around 8 years ago. And we've had plenty of articles over the years looking at what the opportunity is, but also often why we haven't seen that fully exploited yet. There's certainly a big opportunity there, and this panel makes the case for why we're starting to see some movement and we're starting to see telcos playing a bigger role in the advertising space. For this one, our editor-in-chief Vincent Flood was moderating, and we had Albert Yanteb from Liberty Global and Chris LeMay from Cinemedia. So let's go to that conversation now.
Let's kick things off first. Adria, I think it'd be good first for you maybe to give a bit of an insight into Liberty Global and the extent of the business. Dig into the bigger picture of what is Liberty Global.
Good question. Many people might not know Liberty Global, but we have a long history in cable television. Our founder, John Malone, who's an American, once founded a cable company in the US and built it out to the biggest cable company in the country. And then he sold it to AT&T for an awful lot of money. And with that money, he later on started Liberty Global operations, mostly in Europe. We also have a Latin American operation, but the companies have been separated a few years ago. So the brands you all might know, at least in the UK, you all know Virgin Media O2. So there we have a joint venture with O2 from Telefonica. In the Netherlands, we also have a joint venture with Vodafone. It's called Vodafone Ziggo. We have an operation in Belgium called Telenet. We used to own recently, but it got a separate stock listing last year in Switzerland. It's called Sunrise. And not to forget, last but not least, we have Virgin Media Ireland.
The most important, the jewel of the empire.
So what do we offer? Apart from cable TV, the business has massively grown. We added broadband internet in the 80s, early 90s probably, I must say. I was there myself, not at Liberty, but another ISP. And these days we also, we call it fixed mobile converged services. So we offer fixed connectivity services and mobile telephony, and together with cable TV, as it were, so pay TV.
So you own an awful lot of stuff
We do.
I think is it. I think like asking, you know, give me the full overview of your company is typically a lame way to open a panel. But yeah. I think it's such an interesting.
Honestly, we are actually doing more than the telco business, but that maybe is too much to explain today. We are really, you know, a investment company. Liberty Global has a history of buying and selling things. That's basically in their DNA. So maybe a few examples besides the telco business are data services, data centers. Atlas Edge is owned by Liberty. And we invest in car charging stuff in the UK. It's called Believe. So we believe in a better, sustainable world, as it were. And maybe last but not least, we own Formula E. So the electrical version of Formula One.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. That's very cool. That's a surprise to me. Chris, I think it'd be good for, you know, I don't take for granted that, I know in the broadcaster and telco world, Cinemedia is everyone knows who they are, but it's a mixed audience. That's be good to explain where it's you're coming from.
I feel like I've just been set up after that. We don't own any formulas, unfortunately.
Just lie, Chris.
So we own Ireland.
This is a nice story, I think, because our sister company, Liberty Media, which is also owned by John Malone, owns the Formula One rights. So I guess our CEO wanted to have something similar.
Okay, so No. So Cinemedia, I'm not sure how well known Cinemedia is actually from our industry perspective. It was a lesser known name to me. Cinemedia has been around for a very, very long time, and it's predominantly thought of as a kind of a video broadcast infrastructure type company. And there were, broadly speaking, two divisions of it. There was the video networks division, which is very much kind of hardware and broadcast playout infrastructure, boxes. And then there was the media technologies division, which is the kind of software as a service platforms for things like video players, short video players, the Iris admonetization platform, and all the kind of software solutions. It's a global outfit, so we're kind of everywhere from Asia across MENA, Europe into Latin America and the US. But I guess Europe is probably the stronghold, really, I think, geographically for us. But what we're seeing at the moment is that everything everywhere is kind of on the up, which is nice. Bit of technology, bit of hardware.
And I know earlier in the year we were chatting, and there's very, very few. I mean, I'm doing this 14 years now, and it's very it's quite unusual for me to get excited about, oh, that's changed my perspective on the industry, or, you know. And I think it's particularly as things have matured a little bit. But you were talking about the telco opportunity and the gold mine that they're potentially sitting on, which is something that it felt like a little bit of a blast from the past, because I remember that everybody recognizing that in the early days of, you know, as we were moving towards CTV. But I think we saw people maybe make slightly half-hearted attempts to get involved in advertising. But you were saying, oh no, the momentum's really here now, and we're seeing change happening globally. Yeah. And I got very excited about this. So maybe expand a bit on what's so exciting at the moment.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, we've been around a bit, haven't we, for a few years now. And I must admit, you know, there was a whole bunch of people in this industry that looked at telcos back in the day and were kind of like, ooh, there's quite a lot going on there in terms of kind of asset and resources and capabilities from a marketing and advertising perspective. And I guess a little bit like some of the OEMs, and I mean, not to disparage them, because they're doing a great job, but I kind of always felt like the OEMs could lean in, the LGs and the Samsungs, lean in a bit quicker to the opportunity that presented itself for them. And so I think with the telcos, what we're starting to see now, they do have a unique set of kind of, you know, assets available to them. But I think what we're starting to see is that around the world, there's more of a realization that, because of the economic pressures that are on their businesses, they need to look for alternative revenue streams, ways in which they can protect their business moving forward. Because I think there's a lot, I mean, AJ will know better than I do, there's a huge amount of opportunity for them, and obviously Liberty's doing a phenomenal job at it, but there's also, for a lot of those telcos, there's a threat from some of the other players, you know, the Starlinks and the Leos and things like that. And I think they're they're looking to cement their future, and they know that they play a part in advertising. They're trying to figure out what part do we play, how do we bring value to it. So I think that's kind of what's driving the recent momentum amongst them.
Yeah. And AJ, I'm curious about, we always talk about, they own this, they own that, they've got the infrastructure. I'm curious, what does owning a broadband network particularly give you, or even a mobile network, that in terms of a competitive advantage,
Well, basically, all our customers are our subscribers. So they like our services, they value our services, and we have a billing relationship with them. So we know where they live, and we basically have a trusted relationship. Maybe not so much for the TV, although we have a long history in TV, but even more so with regards to connectivity, because providing connectivity requires, not only quality, but also looking after people's privacy, for example. And that makes it a trusted relationship, and it also gives us access to data. We know where people live, so we can enrich that data with viewing data, for example, and that obviously helps in monetizing the advertising opportunities.
And Chris, can you think of like specific companies or perhaps even a region that's particularly jumps out at you as being, really exciting on the telco front, or that they're particularly advanced?
Europe. I mean all of them. If I'm honest, all of them. Because I've got conversations in LATAM, I've got conversations in India, and in across in APAC. Europe, we've got two new telcos coming on board now with us. And Europe, I think, is leaning in harder and faster to this notion of not only their strategic future as a telecommunications company, but also where can they bring value, because they know they can. And what AJ just mentioned there, that trusted billing relationship as a service provider, where I've not only got the broadband into the house, but I've also got the mobiles as well. So those persistent identifiers make a massive difference. But Europe, I think, is where I'm seeing the most urgency, let's put it that way, for sure.
I guess the US market changed massively in the last couple of years because of the cord cutting. Yeah. That's the right word. And people were jumping into the smart TV because the cable bill was far too expensive. There were lots of opportunities elsewhere with the SVOD apps, etc. So that change that transformed the business in the US massively. And Europe has a very strong European broadcasters, public service broadcasters, either it be non-commercial or commercial, still have a very strong viewership, although it's slowly declining. So there is a long-term threat, you could say. But at least it provides a lot of scale. And so apart from the things I mentioned before, scale is still important, and especially on the linear channels, we have a lot of scale. Video on demand as well, but that differs from market to market. So for example, in the UK, we don't have a lot of video on demand anymore because everything is done by the broadcast apps these days. Mm. But in other markets, it's different. It's still on the Liberty platform, and we try to help our broadcast partners to monetize things in an addressable way. Because purely linear, we don't have any added value, obviously.
Yeah. Increasingly, we're buying TVs that already come with a, very nice, glossy, well-designed operating system built in. I'm curious about, how are telcos responding to that?
This is the most exciting bit from my perspective, because this is the bit that I've sort of learned a lot about over the course of the last year of these discussions. And this, I think, is also one of the reasons that feeds into why the telcos are starting to go, ooh, maybe we start to understand quite where we fit in. Now, there's a little bit of blue sky thinking going on here, but I mentioned earlier there's a kind of an existential threat from things like Amazon's Leo and Starlink in terms of connectivity into the home, right? So if I've spent hundreds of millions of euro digging the roads up and putting cables in so that I can get hard wires into my customers and give them mobile phones, I don't then want somebody to just shine a light down on them and take those customers away from me. So trying to concrete my relationship and build some kind of defensive moat against that threat is important. Now, you'll all be aware, I'm sure, of Sky Glass. Sky, some time ago, I think it was probably 2017, 2018, when it actually started the project, where Sky, very insightfully, I think, realised back then that they needed to take control of the glass, because they're not LG and they're not Samsung and they're not Sharp. But they realised that if you own the hardware, then you really own the keys, right? Because otherwise, you can be on those screens, but you're going to get pushed to where, you know, those OSs want you to be. And so I think one of the really interesting things that's happening at the moment, and this is where it gets really exciting, is telcos very much leaning into the idea of providing glass for their customers, screens, I mean. And I think this is an imminent opportunity, but it's also a very long-term opportunity for them, because they're thinking in ways where, well, we're not going to call it a TV, and it's not going to be one. It's going to be screens, various, and there'll be multiple of them in houses as we go forward. And they're starting to look at things like edge AI capabilities within those screens, because the processing power in those screens is vastly superior to what it was 12 months ago, and in another 3 years, it'll be vastly superior again. So all of this ability to manipulate video on the fly, but more importantly, truly own that piece of real estate, that's the really interesting opportunity that's going along with it. And then obviously you bolt advertising into the back of that. Now as a telco, I've got a range of model possibilities of where I might fit in the ecosystem. And that, broadly speaking, they range from, you know, at the small end, there's the enabler, which is, you know, to AJ's point about the broadcasters, I'm just going to enable the broadcasters to do what they need to do from an addressability perspective and not much else. At the other end of the spectrum is what I just discussed, where is we own the house, we own all the screens, we have the persistent deterministic identifiers, we can do reliable modelling and measurement and reach and frequency and all the things that marketing's been asking for a long time, but everybody's got to come through us because it's my pipes. That's a very different scenario to what we've had for a very long time. And I think now they're starting to take it a lot more seriously.
It's an incredible... You'd be great to... I mean, yeah, if you ever want to move into sort of telco sales, I feel like that's a, that's a very compelling vision.
Do you know, jokingly, your post, you know, telcos are sexy again, who knew?
Yeah.
And actually, I hadn't thought... You're kind of right, because yeah. It's like, oh my God, you've literally got all the component pieces. We've all known it for a long time, but there now seems to be a genuine appetite to go, okay, people, let's do this. Let's bring this all together in a way that guarantees our future. Because if I can put a TV screen bolted on the wall in your house and provide your broadband and your router, and they're all optimized together, and I own the remote control basically, I'm in the driving seat, really. You know, everybody's going to have to pay to use my pipe.
Sounds like blue skies.
Right?
AJ's eyes are lighting up.
AJ's now going to tell us all the reasons why you can't do it.
Well, it's obviously easier said than done. As you might know, Liberty doesn't have Sky Glass type of proposition yet. Obviously, we have been looking into this, and maybe we are considering it. Decisions still need to be made. But for you know, a big part of our customers, the set-top box is still you know, the default you know, destiny to go for, and it has proven to be, you know, reliable and a valuable source of, you know, enjoying TV. So apart from looking at opportunities to maybe own the glass, we also look at the wider customer experience and the type of content we are offering in different packages together with connectivity. You know, that makes our proposition, I think, still quite interesting. Although there are some threats on the horizon, especially with the younger type of audiences who seem to be you know, apps first, and all the apps are on smart TVs. You know, potentially we might have missed part of that boat, although we work closely together with the SVOD providers. And we're not only aggregating those, we consider ourselves as being a super curator we see aggregation as a bit of a commodity. We like to curate the content. So we like to provide the right type of content for the customer at a, you know, affordable price. Obviously, we need to keep it balanced. You know, we can't stack all the asphalt services on top of it, things together, because then it gets too expensive. But back into the smart TV, the biggest challenge is not only the investment you need to make, because, you know, the TV device is a lot more expensive than a set-top box.
Yeah.
But also, people have a brand preference. And we're not yet convinced that, you know, the telco brand would be strong enough to you know, ask people to buy a, you know, a cable TV, so to speak. So we're considering options. Maybe we're going the Magenta way, you know, or what Deutsche Telekom is doing. I don't know if people know, but Deutsche Telekom is working together with VIDAA, the VIDAA operating system. And basically, the VIDAA operating system gets a UI UX from Magenta TV. That's in the works. That's being developed currently and launching probably end of this year, next year. Who knows? Maybe that's a good option, because then you still have, you know, the TV brand, and then you have the operator powered operating system behind it.
That's similar to the model that there's a company called, they're Red Squid TV, and they're an operating system manufacturer, and they work with TV other basically they work with loads of manufacturers other than LG and Samsung, so Sharp and Philips and people like that. Because you're right, AJ, choice of brand of TV is quite important, and their model's really interesting, and that's the one that I know there are a few other telcos considering, because there's no capex with that.
Right, because if you buy the TV directly from the manufacturer, not through retail, there's no retail markup. So the TV just went down by about 40% in price to start with. And what happens is the manufacturer installs the Red Squid. I mean, Red Squid, that's the company name, but it would be Telco OS on it. Shoves it out the door and delivers it directly to you at home. Because let's face it, nobody goes to Currys and buys a 65-inch TV and puts it under their arm and walks out now. Right? It's all deliverable. So they deliver it directly to your door, pre-installed, and pre-paired with all of the other devices, things like the routers and bits and pieces in your house as well. There's no capex for the telco, right? Because it's all financed. You're paying for it through an extra £5 a month, and you get to pick the TV that you want. You can pick the same.
Basically, the mobile telephony model.
Yeah, yeah, it's exactly that. And I'm yeah, the idea is they're gonna
you still need to you know, buy the TVs, but it's financed, indeed.
But it's been financed by the manufacturers. Crucially, that's the thing. So the telco is not having to fork out, because it would be a gazillion quid, right? If I have to buy everybody a TV, it's going to be an expensive game. But if I can finance it, so there's no capital expenditure, and by doing it, I put it in. So Sky did it differently with Sky Glass. Sky built TV, and that's great. But I'm not entirely sure that's probably the best way to go. I think give people the choice of what they want to buy, and just the opportunity for the telco to own it.
Yeah, it might feel like locking. So if you're fed up with Sky, where do you go? And your TVs may be worthless.
I feel like I played through Sky under the bus there, but yeah.
We love Sky.
We love Sky. Good partners of ours.
Big castle.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I love Sky too.
You know, seriously, I think the Sky Glass market is maybe about 10% of their subscribers. So. It's not like the 100% you want to get to, maybe in theory, or maybe 50% whereas a set of boxes or whatever.
Yeah, a good start. We're back up with the final question. I'm curious, what do you think is the biggest, you know, untapped opportunity for telcos?
I think it's the one we've just been talking about, if I'm honest. I think it's not one single kind of asset or resource that they have. It's all the things that AJ spoke about in terms of that trusted services provider relationship they have with their consumer base, and all of the associated sort of infrastructure and data resources that come along with that. And then this opportunity to kind of close that last gap. And I think, you know, the set-top box, as you say, for most telcos is still the predominant connection. But the problem with that is it goes into HDMI 1. which when you buy a new smart TV is not what comes up on the screen first, right? You have to make a choice to go there. And that I think is the danger of them being disintermediated by not being able to get through to the screen. So for me, I think it really is this, this opportunity to kind of cement themselves in the home, and then figure out where they sit in that advertising ecosystem. Because I think we're going to see with the scale of outfits like AJ's, there is a genuine opportunity for them to become a media buying destination, a platform in their own right. So I think it's a bit of a fluffy answer, but I think it's all of those things that actually have come together in a perfect storm. And I think now there is the willingness at C-level to kind of go, we have to do something, and this is starting to look like a pretty attractive proposition to us. So I think it's that.
It's a good. It's a complex thing, because also the content part, the content angle is important. You see a lot of consolidation in the market. Most obvious example is a recent example, Fox buying Roku, but others like a Disney partnership with TFO in France. So there's a huge consolidation wave going on, and we basically need to adapt. You could say we've already done that in a way, because in some of our countries we own broadcasters, and that also gives us a position in the advertising market. We have our feet, into the advertising mud, so to speak. But with regards to your question, what's the most untapped yet source? It might be data. We're trying to do things with data. We're already doing things with data. But I think with the current state of AI development, there's much more to be done.
Super, gentlemen, I hope that left you with a renewed appreciation of the telco opportunity, which, is something that, it's great to be excited about something new again.
Next up, we had a discussion of why premium brands still need premium TV. This discussion of premium is a fairly constant one in the TV world, and sometimes can feel like a fluffy one. But there is real meat there, and there are real consequences for advertisers when it comes to aligning themselves with quality, truly premium media. I moderated this one, and I was joined by Mike Mathieson from IAS and Lindsay Turner from BBC Studios.
Our topic today, it feels quite fitting for Cannes, because I think Cannes is a good demonstration that the industry really does care about premium. We don't optimize our spaces for the amount of people we can get in a room. We try and get nice rooftops where you have a good view out over the cross set or a really nice yacht. So we do care. We do understand the value, and we want to see how that plays out in CTV. So to start, can my panelists please introduce themselves? We'll start with you, Mark.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me on this very warm day in Cannes. My name is Mike Mathieson. I head of product marketing at Integral Ad Science, so known as IAS. And appreciate everyone coming out on this very warm afternoon. Pass it to Lindsay.
Hi, yes, I'm Lindsay. I'm the VP of Digital Growth and Strategy at BBC Studios.
So to start off with, premium is one of these terms that gets bandied about a lot, and people have different definitions of what they're talking about. Sometimes it gets seen as almost a bit of a fluffy term that people just kind of place on themselves without much justification. So I want to dig into what we actually mean and how we justify that. So Lindsay, big to start with you, as the BBC Studios would describe itself, I assume, as a premium publisher. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people might think of premium when it comes to sort of production quality or kind of format, but we think of premium really regarding what is genuinely at a premium now as active attention. So we spent a lot of time thinking, when it comes to our content, what is the content that creates deep affinity, deep active attention with audiences? And so I don't know how many of you are parents in this room, but just as a sort of sidebar, recently I was at a kid's birthday party, and I didn't know any of the parents. I didn't know where I worked. And we were stood there, and there was a pass the parcel that started. And one of the mums leaned over to me and went, "Do you think it'll be Lucky's Dad's Balls?"
And if you're a parent who watches a lot of Bluey, you will understand that that is a very specific, if you know, type of joke. And all the mums of these five-year-olds laughed. And I said, oh, do you like Bluey? And she said, oh, yeah, we're a Bluey family. And that's how she identified herself. And so one of the IPs we have is Bluey. We have Top Gear. We have Doctor Who. We have BBC Earth. And these are hugely passionate fandoms. And so for us, what we're looking for when it comes to kind of premium is deep embedded affinity, deep fandoms that we can then welcome bands into.
I always marvel at the power of the creators of Bluey to impose like games on most of the world's young kids. There's so much, I don't have kids, but from nieces and nephews, so much stuff. I'm like, what are they doing? And Pera's like, it's fun, cool. Mike, from your perspective, obviously you're working with sales companies to help them, sell through advertisers and helping buyers understand what they're buying. What does premium mean to you?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Building on what Lindsay shared, I think it means a lot of different things to different customers and advertisers, depending on where exactly, what is this outcome they're trying to achieve, right? From an IAS perspective, we look at certain quality parameters, right? Things like attention, things like IBT, things like our deep understanding of context down to, you know, the show level, for example. So for certain advertisers, depending on, you know, whatever outcome it is that they're trying to achieve through a connected TV or TV campaign, that's really what we help them understand better is what is the context and some of that rich signal behind an impression or a certain piece of programming. And, you know, the notion that premium, some things that it should always be, is fraud free, should be in highly aligned contextual environments. Those things might, you know, be specific to a particular advertiser. That's our number one goal, is to really help increase that transparency and understanding of the exact type of media that a CTV impression is attached to.
As someone that works with like lots of different companies across the spectrum, why do you think the industry has such a hard time pinning down exactly what we mean when we say premium?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, particularly in the CTV space, there's just been a plethora of fragmentation over the years, right? You have oodles of different streaming TV apps and publishers and broadcasters, some of them that operate both in a linear traditional space as well as a streaming space. And I think that as a result of that, there is a lot of variety in terms of the types of signals that are available. And even, you know, publisher to publisher, app to app, there can be different ways of articulating what those signals are. So I think in terms of helping our clients understand, you know, what does premium mean at scale across the various, you know, environments that they're investing in on CTV, that's really how they can better understand what the quality is or the premium nature of that CTV. That's one of the main goals that we are addressing right now.
I don't want to look as well as like, why should an advertiser care about this? And maybe, Lindsay, for you, if a brand was particularly skeptical, they said, oh, this is just a term where you pay for your own content, sir, ask us to pay a bit more for it. What would you say about what we know about the power of premium? Why does this matter? What does it mean to advertisers?
That's a good question. I think there's a growing body of evidence that says that it is much more effective, whether it's recall, whether it's building memories, whether it's building affinity with your brand. It is worth paying more for context. An ad that runs in front of Bluey or Top Gear, I don't think is the same as an ad that's running on random content somewhere. And so I think that advertisers understand that if you're buying into premium inventory, you're getting, you know, proper active attention, you're getting a engaged audience, and you're getting business effect.
Does that align with what you see there?
Yeah, and I think there's I think one of the important things of that, in particular, is that when we think about TV in a historical sense, it's largely been a reach and awareness channel, right? And I think as we have moved into this digital environment, it is so much more than that. So I think, you know, how we can better attribute CTV to, you know, certain end outcomes and purchases and things like that, like that's very real and tangible. So I think that that's a piece that has historically been, harder to prove in a linear environment. But now with CTV, we have access to those signals and to connect the dots between impression and business result that a client is goaled against. A lot of what Lindsay was sharing definitely resonates. And I think, you know, those core KPIs around ROI and ROAS and conversions, we're much, much better equipped now than ever before to be able to show that customer journey.
So I guess one of the big challenges when it comes to actually buying premium inventory is that there's an element of it's in the eye of the beholder, or I guess, like, you know it when you see it, but you can't put that yet into your programmatic buy or whatever, unless you're buying directly. So we need to look for signals, something we could talk about already, of how we recognize what is a premium when you've not got someone just going through and firing it directly, selecting the content themselves. So for you, Mike, what sort, you've mentioned some already, but what sorts of signals are the most important ones you think that actually help a buyer understand this is good content?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think one of the loudest signals that we continue to hear from clients, and I think the industry at large, is just access to our granular contextual insight about the content itself. So earlier this year, we announced an IS solution. It's called Total TV, and it's really about bringing complete transparency to CTV buys. We're taking a very unique approach with this. We were partnering directly with major CTV apps. We're starting in the US, but we are working with major apps like Disney and Amazon Prime Video, Paramount Global, et cetera. And one of the first transparency goals of this is to include show-level reporting consistently across these CTV campaigns with these major apps and publishers. So I think that that is just one example of how a signal like show-level data, which is not available at large within the bitstream, obviously, in CTV, helping unlock that transparency and delivering it consistently to CTV marketers and advertisers has been a huge ask. And we're really excited that we're able to roll that out at scale across across our advertiser clients.
So I guess that is giving a brand that power to see, okay, this is the specific content we ran against, and then make that judgment for themselves if this does or doesn't align with what I feel. Lindsay, from your point of view, like, maybe you could just talk us through how BC Studio sells its content, because you work primarily with YouTube. So is it about selling specific shows? Is it about the specific, like you say, those big titles that you sell against and buyers can buy directly to Top Gear or Pluri or whatever it is?
Yeah. I would say, yeah, take the risk out of, needing show levels analysis and just buy direct, guys. Just be like, these are the shows that I want. This is the premium stuff that I'm looking for, in the way that you would have had you pick your own on TV. Connected TV is just kind of telly. All TVs are connected now. It's like saying I've got a connected phone. Like, it's just not really how people think. And so, yeah, I think what we find is that people want to come to us and primarily buy around a specific show, but we are working on affinity networks where we can bring some other shows together and you can buy across that network of shows within a particular vertical. So that's something that we are cooking up, and I think will be, again, advertisers going to really, really like. But primarily they come and say, we want to be around the biggest global kids phenomenon or the autos destination, and that seems to work really well.
And in terms of how you understand, because you've got a bunch of inventory across lots of different shows, how do you understand what's really your most premium content? Is it just the brands come to you and they know what they want and that's your signal, kind of market demand? Or is it you look up the metrics that you get from YouTube?
Yeah, it's a combo, but mostly the metrics. So hours watched, especially average view time. We're not really we don't care that much about scale because we have it. Our channels are huge. So it's not really a scale play. It's a depth of engagement play. And so we want to make sure that we're making content, we're building out ecosystems around these brands that are exciting and completely focused on what the audience wants. And we judge that based on how much time they spend with the content.
So one interesting dynamic in this conversation is that Lindsay, you're obviously very like buy direct and you know exactly what you're buying against. In the world you work in, Mike, a lot of the time there's been a reluctance from the sell side to share full transparency, which is why, you've launched this new product. Why has that been the case? I hear lots of different reasons of why that's the case. Why, in your opinion, has that been the case? And are we seeing change on that front now, given that you've got quite big brands involved in Turbo TV?
Yeah. So first I will say, I think every player in our industry, whether you sit on the sell side, the buy side, or the technology that, bridges those things, I believe everybody understands the importance of transparency and providing that. It helps publishers better,
realize the monetization of their premium content. It helps advertisers better understand how their investments are performing and where they are, where those impressions are going. So I think, you know, to say up front, I think every participant in our industry is leaning in, and particularly now. And I think part of it is just the evolution or the maturity of CTV as the new TV format. It's like that is where audiences are spending time and where end customers are spending time. So yeah, I just believe that it's, you know, partially the maturity of it as a format, coupled with the advantages being a digital format and that increased precision that marketers can achieve with access to those additional signals. I think that is truly the momentum behind the movement of now, why we're starting to see this greater appetite to provide things like show level signals, etc.
And do you think we're getting to a place where sell side companies are, I guess, rewarded for their transparency, that they will see the benefits of more money coming?
Yeah, I mean, the benchmarks are just rising, right? Like, I think, and if we just look at the history of television in general, you know, it was born in this linear format, and there were certain expectations of what that buy would include and what type of measurement and insights would be provided with those campaigns. And we're now seeing that translate into the, you know, the connected environment or the streaming environment.
And Lindsay, from your point of view, I'm just interested in, I guess, at a broad level, because we talk a lot about the benefits of transparency and getting rewarded for that, the benefits of premium, the value to advertisers. In the market as you see it at the moment, do you think buyers really do recognize the value of premium, and are premium publishers rewarded for their content? Or do you sometimes see misalignment between what advertisers might say and what they actually then go and do in the market?
Yes. So I would say that, broadly speaking, yes, I think buyers and particularly clients really value transparency. They value knowing exactly where their money's going. They don't just care about cheap. Anyone can go and buy cheap. There's tons of dross out there if you want to buy cheap, and that's fine if that's what you want to do. But I think what buyers and clients are increasingly wanting is quality context, knowing where their money's going, knowing where their brand's going to show up, because uncertainty is expensive, actually. You know, it's premium is effective, it's great value, because you have a much higher likelihood of it working for your brand. And I think marketers don't want the uncertainty. They want to remove some of that. Years ago, one of my, a good friend of mine was a client, and she said to me, I worked at a different business at the time, and she said, oh, we're buying loads of your stuff. You know, it's just exciting. We're, you know, have a look, where our brands are going to be on your sites. And then I looked, and actually it was like £300. And it's because our logo had been on a P&P slide, and she thought a load of money was coming on us, and she thought that her brands were going to show up on our site, but they definitely weren't. So she was not happy, and she went off and had a conversation with the agency, etc. And I think that a lot of clients have been burnt by that kind of experience, and so they are asking more questions, and agencies are having to show more transparency, and I think that's a good thing.
Something that, Lindsay, you just shared, and I think it's a great point, is this notion of uncertainty and it being costly. And the reality is, where we are at in the TV environment right now, there's no need for it. Why guess? The tools are there, the signals are there, and I'm going to borrow that quote, because uncertainty is very costly. So, yeah, plus one to that, Lindsay. That makes it resonates.
Nice. So one of the dynamics that I suppose sometimes leads people to buy and be content to buy, let's call it less premium inventory, is if they're doing pretty granular audience targeting over the top of that, which we can debate about the accuracy of it, but that's what they're doing. That then kind of complicates things, I guess, when you try and bring that to premium inventory, because if premium inventory is already commanding a higher CPM and then you're trying to add data targeting on top of that, that is going to drive prices up, and it also just means you're going to maybe not get the pure reach that might be some of the benefit of that premium content. So do you guys think there is a bit of a conflict between those two things, or do you think they can live happily side by side?
Sometimes I think they can be. I think the juice has got to be worth the squeeze. I think that if you, data's brilliant, but sometimes you just don't need it. if you're in the social environment, the algorithm's going to do a lot of that heavy lifting for you, and you're just choking it. So in that environment, I'm not sure there's a lot of point. I think agencies have made a lot of time, put a lot of time and effort into what can be seen as sort of busy work, which is over targeting. Sometimes it's really important, and if it is a very niche audience, then I totally get it. But if you can shortcut that by going, I want a Bluey family, I want a Top Gear fan, I want a Doctor Who fan, I want, you know, BBC Earth, you know, everybody loves Attenborough. He's like the grandfather I never had. You know, do I want to be around his stuff? Yes. You know, and I think you can shortcut targeting with context a lot of the time.
Yeah, plus one to that. I think when we think about the different strategies that marketers implement, audience targeting, a lot of value. Contextual relevancy, a lot of value. We very much view these as complementary depending on what specific strategy or outcome a client is looking to achieve. But we don't look at those things as in competition with each other.
Okay. Then one topic I want to look at for you, Mike, is obviously the impact of AI. There's the word. I think it is particularly interesting in this space because, as I said earlier on, there's that element with premium of you know it when you see it. And the issue pre-AI is that you need to essentially, to my understanding, encode what you want into a series of yes-no decisions. Does it have this property? Does it have this property? Yes-no. And then you kind of figure out through that algorithm whether it works for you or not. To my understanding, AI has the potential to be a bit more as if you were sending a human into the market to look at this and say, does this fit with what we think is good or not? So I don't know whether that's accurate or not, or that's just my perspective. Yeah. But could you talk a bit about like how you guys are seeing AI's use case in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to talk about it through two quick dimensions. So first, AI is an enabler of content generation. It is helping creators of all types and sizes, independent creators, studios, etc., create content at a pace that we've never experienced. So with that, there's an increasing amount of digital content across the internet, across apps, all the places where I'm sure many of us spend too much time on our phones looking at all day. With that, and part of our responsibility at IAS and what we are focused on is measuring and understanding the quality of that media, the context, et cetera, and we do implement AI tools to help us do that at scale. But I think the piece that you're touching on, which is a really important one, is that it's always with human in the loop. The machines are helping us accelerate and expand our ability to analyze content at scale and that increasing scale that AI is enabling. But we're always doing it, you know, with very specific precision, human in the loop, you know, review of that. And it's really creating an enablement layer for us to be able to continue to scale at the pace of the AI-generated content.
So just to wrap us up, I just want to, I guess, you know, we've got this title of why premium brands still need premium TV. Hopefully, we've made a bit of the case for that. With the market as it operates at the moment, and, you know, I know, for example, Mike, your product is still new to the market this year, so we'll see how that unfolds over time in terms of how buyers and sellers react to it. But as the market is at the moment, if nothing changes in the next 5 years, where do you think we end up? Do you think premium media owners are going to kind of struggle as a result of that? Do you think we need more faster change than we're seeing at the moment? Or do you think the industry is at a good place where it's at right now and people kind of need to keep doing what they're doing, maybe opening up a bit more transparency-wise?
So we still have a lot of hard work to do as an industry in this space, but I will say the tailwinds that we're experiencing and some of what we talked on earlier about this joint force of wanting to provide increased transparency and understanding, I think that that tailwind is going to only continue to move faster. When I think about the five-year horizon, I think that the access to tools, the ease of use to activate CTV and better understand it, I think that we're seeing a massive democratization of TV. You know, historically, it was very much for large brands and the largest marketers in the world. Programmatic and CTV is making it very, very accessible to brands of all shapes and sizes, from small and medium-sized businesses. And so I think over the next 5 years, we're only going to see that adoption and engagement continue to increase, along with the accessibility to these tools and understands to really prove the value of those investments.
Lindsay, to close us off, from your point of view, if you could make one ask of
buyers something that you wish they'd understand better or do a bit more of, what would that be?
Oh, that's a fun one. I would say have the conversations. You know, I think especially it's hard. It's, you know, we've never been busier. The level of information that the agency is having to have across multiple platforms, very, very complicated. You know, I was chatting to a TV buyer last night and they said it used to be so easy. And now it is complicated. So I get that shortcuts and trying to make it as simple as possible. It makes life so much easier. But I would say have some of the conversations direct with some big players that will be worth having because every agency and buyer is looking for differentiation, what they're offering, what their agency is offering, and they also are looking for success for their brands. So there are loads of fruitful conversations to be had. One of those would certainly be with BBC Studios, but there'll be lots of others out there. So, yeah, I would say take the time to have the chats and see what we can do together.
Brilliant. Well, that's all from us. So please join me in thanking my panelists. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
And finally, to close us off, we had a fireside chat with Ed Couchman, who heads up ad sales in the UK for Netflix. It's been really interesting to follow Netflix's entry into the ad market since they launched nearly 4 years ago, partly because of the fact that they've shown themselves willing to listen to the needs of the market and adapt, rather than trying to come in and immediately disrupt the ways TV advertising works. Here, Ed talks about the company's strategy, how it's growing its ads business, and where the streaming giant is now looking to innovate.
So, have been any surprises since coming in, you know, in terms of what your perception of what it was going to be like and what it's actually like?
Yeah. Thanks. Hi, everyone. As Vince said, I'm Ed Couchman. I lead the UK advertising business for Netflix and been enrolled about 7-8 months. Do you know what? I think I was struck by two things, actually. One side that I really underappreciated was just the amount of great content the UK team were commissioning. I think I was very familiar with the sort of the US big tent poles, you know, like Wednesday or Stranger Things. But actually, we have so much content coming out of the UK. Obviously, some great shows like, you know, The Gentleman or Bridgerton. And then I'm not sure if anyone's been watching Legends recently. You know, it's a story about some UK custom officers in the 90s. So that's brilliant. And then we've got loads of great UK content coming. But I think I underappreciated how much we're investing in the sort of UK creative. That was one side. Combine that with a team that are really leaning into ads, and actually they really want to understand the ads business. They see how important, so that was a really pleasant surprise. And then the other thing was actually it was a data point. It was a fun fact, not one show contributes more than 1.5% to total viewing. And I think there's this sort of misperception that, you know, that we have this sort of series of big global hits, but actually it's not that at all. They are big in that moment, but across the whole year, we have a whole range of a depth and breadth of content that sort of keeps people coming back. And again, I don't think I realised that.
And obviously, your heritage is Meta, Snap, Spotify. And I can remember the early days. I remember you speaking on stages at these conferences too, where the TV industry was often like they were kind of deriding, you know, platforms as, you know, oh, it's cat videos, it's, you know, it's never going to scale, how they've eaten their words since, I think. But I'm curious, you know, I always think that there's something both sides can learn from the other. And you know, what could the TV industry learn from digital and vice versa?
I think that's fair. There is a sort of mutual learning or understanding. I think I would try and use the sort of art and science analogy, essentially, that maybe TV companies have been really good at the art historically, like making great shows, building relationships with their viewers, and understanding that and sort of and marketing those shows. And I think maybe digital has much been around the science. And I think this sort of, and you can see it happening right across the industry, obviously this week with this sort of coming together, the art and science, and obviously that's taking place on Netflix as well. But, you know, thinking about the technology, thinking about what's driving the sort of ad experience and bringing that two things together, the great content, the art, and the science of the sort of ad tech stacks, essentially. I think that combination of the two.
You know, even though, I mean, I think, you know, Netflix is firmly established in the UK at this point, but what does success look like for Netflix advertising in the next 12 months? What's your job?
Yeah, I think quite simply, the viewing landscape has changed, and I think there's a perception reality gap. A perception maybe that actually people are still watching the big linear channels. That's complete myth. That, you know, majority of time now is spent on the streaming VOD services funded by advertising. And I think our job is to stimulate the media planning community to catch up with that change. So the more we can do that, the better. And I think then what does good look like? I think it's around tying a thread between great content, fandoms, the attention that creates for the audience, particularly young audiences, and then be able to draw a straight line or thread through to outcomes and business outcomes. And that, I think if we can do that, I think that'd be really successful and create some really brilliant creative work on the surface. I think that'd be like, that would be what we set out to achieve.
And I'm curious about what's the, you know, when you're going in for, you know, an agency pitch or whatever else, what differentiates you? You know, I think at the consumer level, you know, you're confronted with the various platforms and there's a lot of parallels. You'll see some points of differentiation, but I'm curious about how do you, you know, differentiate Netflix from your competitor set?
Yeah, we absolutely start with the content. You know, we obviously start with some of those shows like Legends, Gentlemen, Wednesday, Strange Things, all those things, because they've built this sort of cultural relevance. They're in the cultural vernacular. They're in the national conversation. They're meaningful. And the majority of brands that we speak to want to be part of culture. That's an important element for them. So we start with that. And then we talk about the sort of reach and scale of the service. So according to Barb data, 15.3 million people tune into Netflix a month, 4.9 million people every day. And that's just on the ads tier. And that normally gets like, oh, actually, that's a bit of response. So we're 7% of total commercial TV viewing in the UK. That's including linear. We're 23% of 16-34s. So we're the biggest channel to reach 16-34. So that's a provocation. Combine that, I say, with the great content, and then we talk around actually how we can get the, you know, your ads to the right person at the right time with targeting capabilities and measurement, essentially. But content, reach, attention, fandoms, outcomes.
And you know, Netflix. I can remember when, you know, before Netflix launched advertising, there was probably a little bit of fear from competitors of, you know, they understand data so well, the personalization piece, that there was more of a, probably a slight more of a tech native culture. I know the content's a massive part of it, but I'm curious what types of data are, you know, the most attractive for advertisers? Like, is it first party data that they're after, or is it, you know, the viewing data?
I think truthfully it's a blend of both. And I think there's sort of two ends of that spectrum. At one end, we do talk about using a data clean room and bringing in first party data. You know, that's certainly of interest. But actually, I think what's really sort of spikes the curiosity of brands is, I said, they want to insert themselves into culture or what the nations are watching. Actually, one of our most popular targeting segments are simply our top 10 shows. So right now, obviously, we've got Restless Football is on. It's a sort of daily chat show following the sort of exploits of the World Cup, drops in the morning. That's in our top 10. Brands want to tap into that. They want to tap into the moment. And our top 10 is actually a really popular targeting segment.
So I think one of the interesting things, I was very happy to see Netflix partner with many of our partners and sponsors. But, you know, you've also been building some proprietary tech. So what are you building over there? Yeah.
So we've made some announcements this morning around partnering with Omnicom and Axiom, and I think this is pretty exciting. So essentially, take sort of Axiom, some, you can use that as a data clean room to bring some first-party audience data. Then you can actually use that audience data to target those groups on Netflix. But more interestingly, we can then start delivering different creative to that audience. So far, so good, you say, all pretty straightforward. The exciting part gets actually using generative AI to tailor that creative, adapt that creative to the show you're about to watch. So it pulls in sort of the aesthetics or tonality of the show and makes some modifications or adjustments to the creative to make sure it feels aligned to that show. And that's like this wonderful targets of first-party data, audience segmentation, and also the creative work. So it's going to be fascinating to see what impact that has on efficiency and effectiveness.
And I'm curious about, you know, do you see a future where, you know, all Netflix campaigns are traded programmatically, or will there always be? I mean, Lindsay alluded
to it on the last session. Will there always be, you know, a preference for that, you know, personal high touch relationship where you can maybe...
What did Lindsay say?
I don't know. I assume most salespeople want the opportunity to upsell the other thing or whatever else, and they want to maintain that sort of relationship. I mean, what's
do you know what? You know, we have a well-stated ambition to grow our programmatic revenues and automated. I think the other panel's also talking about how you can sort of break down some of those barriers and trying to encourage brands of all sizes and businesses of all sizes. So absolutely. But I think it will be the majority, but it won't be the 100%. Because I still think there is a place for that sort of direct relationship. I think particularly for us, maybe around some of our live formats, so live sports, I think that tends to be a one-to-one sell. You know, brands want to get into that moment. We had our first live event in the UK back in April. It was a boxing match at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, Tyson Fury versus Mukrovic. You know, that was absolutely a direct one-to-one brand sell, essentially. So I think for those live moments, I think that will still always be direct. And then maybe the sort of scale and always-on work will be through the programmatic channels.
And, you know, performance marketing is the, you know, we've seen Universal ads being launched today, but, you know, officially by the UK broadcasters. And performance marketing is becoming more of a TV conversation than... You know, it has been in the past. And there has been, you know, there's always somebody in the audience who is like, hey, we've been doing sort of DirecTV, you know, sales where a lot of your daytime ads were always direct response for many years. But it's certainly becoming a bigger conversation now. Mm-hmm. Is Netflix playing in that space and what's the pitch if you are?
Yeah. Do you know what, Vince? I think you make a really important point, actually. Yeah. That I think we often think about performance, about lower funnel, direct click, and then purchase within digital channels. But actually, I think TV is a well-proven medium for driving real-world outcomes, i.e. you watch an ad and then you go out at the weekend or that evening to buy something. So those outcomes, I think, are still important. And then how Netflix shows up in, say, media mix modeling for real-world outcomes, very important. But then closer within the sort of digital, so that click... to buy, then we have working on some formats like Centerphone, for example, some QR codes around giving viewers the ability to sort of take an action from seeing an ad, essentially. But so yes, but I think it's important that it's both real world outcomes as well as sort of digital buying patterns.
I'm curious, you know, in terms of what, you know, AI is obviously being implemented across, you know, almost every part of every business. I'm curious, at Netflix, where is it having the most tangible, meaningful impact?
I think I might go back to that creative example, if I may, try and bring it to life a little bit more. So using generative AI to take existing creative assets and to make adjustments to make them feel more in tune with the show. So a real-life example, working with Target, the US retailer, and taking that ad and actually giving it the aesthetic of Bridgerton. So it has like a Regency sort of feel to it. It's also like a horse and carriage to give it that sort of historical period relevancy, but still maintains the sort of core brand elements of Target and still has the same sort of overall creative message, but just feels more in tune with what people are about to watch. So I think actually, and then doing that at scale, I think is really exciting. Two different audience segments as well. Feels brilliant. Because really, I think at the heart of Netflix, like, is the recommendation engine. Like, you always go to Netflix because you know there's going to be something that you want to go and watch. That same sort of technology, that same understanding of viewing behavior is what we're applying to ads. And then ability to do that to creative work, I think is going to be really, really potentially to be sort of really potent.
And I believe that you guys are getting into the upfront game in the UK. You're hosting it, I believe?
Yeah. So, well, thank you for that plug.
Yeah.
It feels like I have a book to launch. So, plug. Yeah. We're really excited to have a really important moment for the ads business in the UK. We're going to put a real marker in the sand. We're going to have an upfront in September. You know, we think it's going to be a pretty important occasion for us. And I think it's going to be this real testament that not just Netflix ads has arrived, but actually we are going to take it to the next level. So like, stay tuned for more, but we honestly think it's going to be a really, really important milestone for us. We can't wait. We've got some special things planned. It's going to be great.
You're selling
it. That's my plug.
You can I give us a sneak preview?
I honestly can't. We want to hold it back a little so people actually come.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to get you over to the bar and then get you drunk and get some secrets and exclusives out of you. So thanks so much for taking the time, Ed. And if you give Ed a warm round.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Thank you.